Well, I'm standing here in the middle of the Santa Clara Convention Center, surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of astrobiologists. Now, that's not something that happens to me or just about anybody else every day.
That's Seth Shostak at the recent Astrobiology Science Conference, or ABSCICON, a meeting of the astrobiological minds. The conference was recently held in Santa Clara, California, near San Jose, where about 400 scientists gathered to present the latest research about life, how it began, and where and how we might find it elsewhere. Seth gathered some of the top stories from the conference, and we'll hear them in this hour. So, back to Seth.
The people here represent a wide range of disciplines, as is appropriate for astrobiology, which, after all, is about the search for life, the understanding of life on Earth, the future of life, anything connected with life that might bear on the question of whether we might have companions out there, either microbial or intelligent. So we have chemists here, we have biologists, of course, geologists, we have astronomers, we have SETI researchers. It's a really eclectic group. And while that is a wonderful thing, it also means that various subsets of this audience have difficulty understanding the other people, but they try. So I think I'll go into this session over here. This one's about super Earths. Now that sounds interesting, super Earths. I think our planet could use some improvement. Deanna, people are talking at this conference about super Earths, and I assume that that doesn't mean that these are worlds where the television programming is better or anything like that. What is meant by super Earths?
Super Earths is a recent term that we've designed to describe planets that have masses between 1 and 10 times the mass of the Earth. And these can come in two flavors. They can be terrestrial-like or they can be ocean-like, meaning they have a lot of water in their surface, so something more like Europa.
Okay, so these are worlds, these are planets around other stars, presumably, that are bigger than the Earth in general, but not enormously bigger. We're not talking about Jupiter-like worlds.
Exactly. The largest you can get with this probably is 3 times the radius of the Earth on average. But most likely, if you're really looking for an Earth analog, so just like Earth, but scale it bigger, it's about 2 times as big as the Earth, so nothing like Jupiter.
Have we found any of these super Earths?
We have. We found 5 of them. We don't know exactly their mass because we cannot see their transiting, meaning there's 2 detections to discover planets, and one of them is the radial velocity method that gives us the minimum mass. And then if they're transiting, meaning that they're eclipsing the star with respect to us, which is the observer, then you would get the radius. So we only have the minimum mass of 5 planets, but that's very exciting because the measurements are really hard to make from the ground, and we already have 2 space missions planned to find super Earths. So in the near future, we're going to have dozens, perhaps even hundreds of super Earths discovered. So right now, we have 5.
So super Earths could, in fact, be habitats for life.
They're potentially habitable planets, yes. And that's something that we're working on, determining exactly what are the things that we need to look for to see if they're habitable. Those are people concentrating on atmospheric signatures. I'm working on what can we model about them to understand their properties to see if they could be habitable. So a lot of people are looking into this subject because it's just fascinating, trying to find something. I think it's very anthropocentric to think that we're the only ones. So people are really pushing to know what we should look for, where we should look for, and how would these planets be like.
Now, you mentioned that some of these super Earths might be totally covered with water. Why would that be?
Because they could have formed in a place in the solar nebula where you could have created much more ices. These are molecules that need lower temperatures to condense out. So yes, you can definitely have planets that have a really large ocean. But we need to think about what we mean by ocean, because when we say ocean planets, we're saying 10% its mass, it's in water. Earth only has at most 0.1%. So even though our ocean is so important for our Earth, we really wouldn't say it's an ocean planet. So when we talk about water worlds, we need to distinguish. Is it planets that really have a lot of their mass in water, or are we saying that we just have Earth with 3 times the ocean? Because if it was Earth with 3 times the ocean, it's still a dry planet compared to the other realm of planets that we were considering.
Okay, so what you're saying is if we had 3 times as much water on Earth, then it would cover up all the continents, all the mountains, it would just be water everywhere. But these worlds have a lot more water still. Does that have any implications for the kind of life you might expect on these things, other than the fact that there probably wouldn't be any things with legs?
Absolutely. I think that's another research field that is exploding, because we want to understand how biased are we to the life that we know. Because life in extreme environments, that's pretty much what people are studying, to see if life could have evolved in planets that have that are so covered with ocean and ices that they might not have light, basically, to do their photosynthesis and reproduce. So under very high pressures, for example, under very different temperatures. So those are experiments that have been carried out. Right now, I think we plead ignorance, saying that we don't really know, but we should expect life to be more ubiquitous, I think. I mean, my personal opinion is that humans, we're fragile. We're fragile human beings. Something, the climate changes, we really suffer. But bacteria and microbes, they're resilient. They can adapt. They can flourish in extreme environments. So we should expect that sort of more primitive life to be more common that may be thought of until now.
Okay, Deanna, you said that within the next couple of years, it's probable that we'll find lots and lots of super Earths. But is there going to be any way to determine if there's any life on them?
So that'll take us a few more years. That'll take us maybe in the next decade when we have the James Webb Space Telescope in space, because that telescope will be able to tell us signatures in the atmosphere. And we know that there's some signatures very particular to our Earth just because we have life. So if we look for those signatures in other planets, and that telescope will give us that capability, then we'll be able to say they're habitable. Right now, we just need to extract as much information from the limited data that's going to arrive, which is going to be mass and radius. But we're in pretty good shape. We need to lay the framework right now so that when that data arrives, we have everything to work with and give us a sense of, really, are we alone? Are we the only planet that's habitable? I don't think so.
Deanna Valencia, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Deanna Valencia is a planetary physicist at Harvard University. Well, we'll hear more from Seth in his visit to the conference, but right now he's back in the studio. Hi, Seth.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Well, it's nice to be back in this familiar chair, Molly.
Hey, did you like the conference?
I enjoyed it. Unfortunately, there was so much to be heard that you really couldn't attend at all. I mean, the sessions overlap, so I missed a lot of interesting things.
We need to clone you. Now, 5 super-Earths have been found out of 300 planets. Do they expect to find more?
You bet. In fact, it's probably safe to say that in the long run, we'll discover a lot more smaller planets, super-Earth-sized planets, than those Jupiter-sized behemoths. But the other interesting thing here is that one or two of these super-Earths might be orbiting just in the zone where liquid water could exist on their surfaces.
Now, Deanna talked about water worlds. Would that be like that Kevin Costner film where the polar ice caps melt and then there's water everywhere, no continents at all? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, that is. I mean, that seems to be a real possibility. And what's also possible is that such a world could have life. Maybe not Kevin Costner life.
Maybe Colin Firth?
Yeah, but microbes and maybe some interesting sea creatures.
Well, no, this idea of a habitable zone around a star where a planet could be orbiting and get just enough sunlight so the water would neither freeze or boil, could you actually have habitable zones that were bigger? I mean, are there habitable zones for an entire galaxy?
Well, you mean better and worse galactic neighborhoods.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, some people think so. And one of them is Australian cosmologist Charlie Lineweaver.
Charlie, you've done some research that suggests that maybe the entire galaxy isn't perfectly suited for the development of life or sophisticated life like ourselves.
Well, there's something called a circumstellar habitable zone. That is a region around a star where, if you put an Earth, there would be water on this Earth. So let's take that and extrapolate to the level of the galaxy. There are about 400 billion stars in the galaxy. The Sun is one of them. And we can say, now if the Sun, let's say we're just at the center of the galaxy, well, that was not a good place to have life because there's a 3 million solar mass black hole at the center. There's an accretion disk, and there's all kinds of stars. The stellar density is so high that things bang into each other, and there's supernova going off. So that would be a really bad place for the Sun to live. It's a bad neighborhood. Also, if you get really far away from the center of the galaxy, well, there are very, very few stars. It's kind of like living out in the boondocks. There may be living organisms out there, but there aren't that many stars, and so there aren't that many chances to form life, even if there are habitable planets. So you can do calculations of, well, where's the habitable real estate in the galaxy? And that's what we did.
Okay, so you're talking about those circumstances that would allow the development of life, and presumably also life that would be around long enough to perhaps cook up some intelligence.
Well, you know what? In reality, we were guided by the prerequisites for life, but what we really did was talk about the prerequisites for forming an Earth-like planet. One condition, as I just mentioned, is You don't want to be so close to the center of the galaxy that you have all kinds of supernova going off all the time and stars colliding and all kinds of X-rays from the central core of the galaxy. That's one thing. Another thing is you have to have enough metallicity. That means you have to have enough elements that are non-hydrogen and non-helium. And so the first stars in the universe did not have Earth-like planets around them. It was impossible because the material for them was not there. So the next step, you say, well, let's calculate how the buildup of these materials, how it went. And so what I did was take how much oxygen and iron and silicon there was in the galaxy as a function of position in the galaxy and as a function of time. So that means early on, only the very core of our galaxy had enough of these metals to make Earths. And then, as there were more and more supernova, it produced more and more of these metals, and the metals kind of spread out and made available these metals for stars that were further away from the center of the galaxy.
Well, give me an example. For example, our position in the galaxy is that we're about halfway from the center to the edge, something like that.
Yes, yes.
So how long ago was there enough stuff of the right sort in this part of the galaxy to produce planets like Earth and presumably life like Earth? I mean, you know, obviously it got started here 4 billion years ago. Could it have gotten started 8 billion years ago or even 10 billion years ago?
Right. Good question. The answer is the thin disk of our galaxy, where the sun is about 12 billion years old. The first 2 billion years, the metallicity was not high enough to make an Earth. After that, it started to build up and it became more and more full of the stuff you need to make Earths. So the answer is, at this distance from the center of the galaxy, the first 1, 2, probably 3 billion years, maybe even 4 billion years, there wasn't enough metals to form an Earth. But after then, we started to have enough of this stuff to make an Earth around newly forming stars. So the sun, which formed 4.6 billion years ago, could have formed easily with a terrestrial planet 5.6, 6.6, 7.6, but then you get to 8 and 9, then it says, oh, maybe not, because we don't have enough stuff around it to make Earth-like planets.
So, in fact, there could be neighbors of ours in this part of the galaxy that are literally a couple of billion years ahead of us.
Easily. As a matter of fact, I wrote another paper in which I calculated this, and the average Earth in the universe, in fact, not just the galaxy, is about 1.8 billion years older than the sun.
Are there actually big tracts of the galaxy where you say, you know, this is wasteland. This is a place where you're never going to expect to find planets with life.
Oh, yeah. Those tracts are, A, the simplest, everybody understands this, if there are no stars, there's probably no life. The amount of life in the galaxy is probably directly correlated to the amount of stellar material. That's one thing. The other thing is that right now, in the center of the galaxy, there's apparently too much metallicity. Not too much metal, you know, we're saying we need some metallicity to form Earths. But if you get too much metallicity in a system, then apparently when you form hot Jupiters at a certain distance far away from the sun, and then they migrate in and they essentially destroy any Earths that formed when these other planets form. So you can also destroy Earths if you have too much metallicity. So there's a Goldilocks zone of metallicity, and that excludes the very center of the galaxy.
If you were advising the SETI experimenters where to look in the galaxy, then where would you recommend? Where are all the condos? Where's ET hanging out?
I happen to believe that human-like intelligence and the ability to build a radio telescope are probably very rare abilities, if at all. And so, what you'd like to look at is probably the oldest stars, which are metal-rich. These are around the bulge of the galaxy. These are the oldest ones, and they were enriched in metals very early on, and so the oldest terrestrial planets in the galaxy are probably in as part of this bulge component of our galaxy, and that's one good place to look, I think.
All right, Charlie Lineweaver, thanks for the advice where we ought to point our telescopes. The trouble is, of course, that the bulge is a little bit far away. I mean, the signals are going to be weak.
That's your problem, Seth.
Okay. Charlie, thanks very much for talking to me and advising me.
You're welcome, Seth.
Charlie Lineweaver is a cosmologist at the Australian National University. Well, Seth, now Charlie has given you some advice on where to do your SETI searches. Are you going to follow it?
Well, I mean, it's good advice, but what he's saying is to look at stars that are very, very far away. And of course, the signals from those stars would be quite weak. So I'll have to weigh that possibility.
Sounds like a no.
And coming up, more life stories from Earth and beyond, viruses in space, And why is the universe hospitable to life at all? It's Are We Alone from the SETI Institute.
Hey, do you live in a habitable zone? If so, why not improve the quality of your habitation by joining Team SETI? You'll have the satisfaction of knowing that you support the research and educational work of the Institute. You'll get our glossy quarterly magazine, The Explorer, filled with articles by our scientists, including Seth. Just use that futuristic bit of technology known as the Internet. Go to www.seti.org and sign up. And when you do sign up to become a member of Team SETI, send an email to the radio show, arewealone@seti.org, and we'll send you another glossy item, this one a photograph of Barbara, Seth, Gary, and me, perfect for tidying up around your own habitable zone or as mulch for a really tiny farm. That's www.seti.org, and send us an email to arewealone@seti.org. Welcome back to Are We Alone? We're talking to scientists who attended the recent astrobiology conference in Santa Clara, California, where they talked about the nature of life on this planet and the possibility of it elsewhere. This is the field of astrobiology. And Seth, astrobiology is somewhat of a new word for this new field. Isn't that right?
Well, it is. There have been other words for this field of study. It was once called exobiology and even other things. But in fact, the idea of studying other planets around other stars, looking for life there, maybe finding intelligent life somewhere, you know, of course, that's a fairly old idea, even if the discipline itself is fairly new. And in fact, there were more than 400 astrobiologists at this conference, which was very attractively named AbSciCon.
Sounds kind of like a science fiction conference.
Yeah, well, it stands for Astrobiology Science Convention.
So what do these astrobiologists do when they're milling around in a convention hall?
Well, they're talking about a wide range of subjects. Some of the most important are how and when did life get started on Earth? Why did some of that life eventually become intelligent? That's a big question. Where could life exist on other worlds, and what other worlds are out there anyway? Is there or was there life on Mars or some of Jupiter's moons? How can we search for intelligent life elsewhere? Stuff like that.
That question of how life originated on Earth, that's really one that's up for debate, isn't it? Scientists don't have a clear answer.
They don't. There are lots and lots of theories. People are very imaginative about thinking about how life might have gotten started on our planet. It's important to know that, not just because it would be interesting to know, but simply because if you found that it was something that you would expect to happen on many worlds, then that would suggest that there are indeed many worlds with life. Now, when you talk about the origins of life, usually you're talking about microbial life, single-celled organisms. David Deamer, who's a research scientist at the University of California at Santa Cruz, told me he wants to know more about how the first ones of these single-celled organisms got started. Dave, you're investigating the origins of life, how life got started on this planet, which presumably might give us some insight into how it might get started elsewhere. What sort of investigations are you doing?
Yeah, we're interested in the origin of cellular life. And you know, all life today is basically cells put together into tissues and tissues into organisms. So where did the cells come from?
Where the cells came from. Now, how are you doing this investigation? I mean, presumably you're not looking at, you know, 4 billion-year-old cells. They're kind of hard to find.
We're trying to make cells both from real primitive organic compounds we extract from meteorites. The Murchison meteorite is our particular sample. We're also using material that we can make in the laboratory. Both of these compounds, kinds of compounds, are molecules we call amphiphiles. Now, an amphiphile is like an amphibian. Amphibians like water, they like land. Well, amphiphiles like oil and they like water. And soap is a typical amphiphile. So in a sense, we're blowing microscopic soap bubbles, and we think that part of that is the story of the origin of cellular life.
So you're blowing these bubbles, but of course life is more than just, you know, cell walls. You got to have something inside there. How do you fill the bubbles, and with what?
Yeah, life is more than a bowl of bubbles, I guess is the word there. Yeah, well, life has polymers inside. Life is, when I look at you, for instance, I don't see Seth Shostak, I see polymers, I see proteins, amino acids all linked together. So that's part of what life is protein, long polymeric molecules. The other kind of molecule of life is nucleic acids, DNA and RNA and things like that. Well, somehow, those got together to make the first form of cellular life. We have found a way to capture those kinds of big molecules in microscopic bubbles, as it were, and get them to work.
Okay, well, now I can imagine filling up these bubbles with these compounds that are essential for life, or that we think were essential for life. But on the other hand, if they just sit there, that's not terribly interesting. Do these things actually reproduce? Do they show any, you know, any activity?
Yeah, it's really tough to think about how the first energy was put into the first life, because that's what you're asking. If we don't do anything to this, if there's no energy, they just sit there. Nothing happens. So we have to drive them away from equilibrium. That's the word we use, by adding energy. The kind of energy that we add is any of several varieties, and we really don't know what the first source of energy was, but we happen to use two kinds of energy, one called chemical energy, which just makes things happen spontaneously because the energy is already there, and the other is what we call a fluctuating environment, like a tide pool, getting wet, getting dry, getting wet, getting dry, and that can actually drive polymerization reactions.
What have been the results so far? I mean, have you booked success here? Have you created life in the lab?
Yeah, we've just published a paper in which we show that if you put the pieces of RNA, the nucleotides, as they say they're called, into a lipid matrix and put that into a what we call a fluctuating environment. That's a dry, wet cycling environment. And we use 5 cycles. We let it go dry. We wet it. We let it go dry. We drive the reaction uphill, and out the other end come long strings of RNA.
What's your take on this, Dave? What do you see is happening in the next couple of years? You think this is going to succeed?
Well, I hope that we continue to make progress. We need to make more of this stuff. Right now, we just have microscopic quantities because we're doing it in small amounts, but we are working to make more of it. The other thing we want to do is to, in fact, show that some sort of a replication process is occurring, which we're trying to do right now. Finally, and probably most important, is whether any of these can take on catalytic ability. You know, the first catalysts were probably made of RNA. We even talk about an RNA world where RNA, this nucleic acid, is both a catalyst and a genetic molecule that carries information. So we're going to look around to see whether we can fish out a catalytic activity out of these RNA molecules we're making.
And finally, what about those people who would say, you know, this might be a dangerous line of research? What if he succeeds and that life gets out of the lab? We have no idea what it might do. What do you say to those people?
Well, that's an easy one. In fact, these are going to be such primitive little systems that they're just going to be food for all of the life that now exists on the Earth.
Okay. Dave Diemer, thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay. Thank you.
That was David Diemer, a research scientist at the University of California in Santa Cruz.
Giving me the hard sell, as it were.
Well, we just assume that the cells are the story of early life, and yet there's something biological that's even smaller than cells. Now, there's a big debate over whether or not these creatures are alive, but I'm talking about viruses.
Well, you can hear a lot about extraterrestrial microbes indeed, but what about these extraterrestrial viruses? I mean, do they even exist? And could we find them? Well, Barry Bloomberg, who works at the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, and by the way, who happens to be a winner of the Nobel Prize, thinks viruses shouldn't be getting short shrift in astrobiology. Barry, viruses, kind of a neglected life form, or are they even alive?
Well, they're part of life, which may beg the question, but if, for example, in the astrobiology field, if we found a virus or something like it on Mars, we'd score it as being alive. The virus is a very small microorganisms. They essentially are RNA or DNA covered very often with a kind of protein, chemical protein outside. Interestingly, although much of what we know about viruses emerges from their role as pathogens in humans, the vast majority of viruses, for that matter, the vast majority of microbes, don't cause disease.
Isn't it so that the virus's only goal, if you will, in existence is to make more like itself? I mean, do they do anything useful?
They do replicate, and they use the machinery of cells to do so. But the field that we're in is astrovirology, and we're interested in how viruses or something like them, the predecessors or something that developed into viruses, could have lived many billions of years ago and possibly been one of the earliest forms of life. At that time, they may, let's say they existed before cells developed in biology, they may have been able to replicate without the need to be in what we now think of as a cell. So we're interested in looking at viruses, and particularly viruses in extreme locations. Because one of the major goals in astrobiology is, first of all, to study the origin of life. And one has to consider the possibility that viruses were conceivably the first form. And we're looking for signatures of these that we can identify on Earth that might exist on Mars or Europa or Titan or some of the other places where we hope to look for life in the future.
So you're trying to develop experiments that could be, if you will, flown on some sort of spacecraft to the red planet and look for Martian viruses? Do I understand that correctly?
That might be an ultimate application of the research. At this point, we're trying to study the viruses that live in extreme environments, because those could be a model for what we would find on Mars.
I look at photos of viruses, and they're typically beautiful. They look like some sort of molecular origami to me, that kind of thing. But there's a theory out there that some people subscribe to, that life can infect other worlds by hitchhiking, as it were, on asteroids or meteors or chunks of rock that are thrown off one planet and might land on another one. But, of course, they can't make very long trips before the hazards of space wipe them out. What about viruses? Could you have viruses hitchhiking around the galaxy?
Well, yes, I think even based on what we know, it's quite possible that they could be dormant for tens of thousands, maybe millions of years, and undergo a journey from elsewhere. But that's very conjectural. If we find some in a meteorite one day, then that would provide substantial support.
Finally, Barry. If viruses are implicated in diseases from certain kinds of pneumonia to certain kinds of cancer, and we don't seem to be able to do very much against virus-caused disease, why is it that viruses are so difficult to understand? They look so simple under the electron microscope.
Well, I spent 50 years, most of my life actually, and certainly most of my career, working on medically important viruses. And in particular, hepatitis virus, which has infected a third of the world's population, causes an enormous amount of disease. It is one of the major causes of cancer of the liver, very serious cancer. So I'm very well aware of the importance of that, and having spent a lifetime on it. And it's not quite true that you can't do anything about them. Vaccines are very effective in prevention, and including prevention of hepatitis B virus. And because of the focus on virus in recent years, antivirals are being developed. And they're far from perfect, but they're much better than not having them. So there's the real improvement in that area.
Barry Bloomberg, at the risk of imitating the younger generation, I hope this research area truly turns viral. Thanks very much for talking with me.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Seth.
Barry Bloomberg is a researcher at the Fox Chase Cancer Institute and was the first director of the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Well, I like the idea of looking for viruses on Mars, Seth. Could we find them or other such things on planets around other stars?
Well, obviously it's not easy. After all, viruses are small. But finding bacteria might be easy, believe it or not.
But they're small, too.
Well, indeed. But here's what you can do. You can use a big telescope, if you have a big telescope, to grab some light bounced off the atmospheres of these distant planets. And you might find indications of, for example, oxygen. Well, if you did, that would tell us there's some photosynthesis going on that planet. And that means finding microbes, even though they're light years away. It's kind of amazing.
Why couldn't you use that technique to detect viruses?
Well, viruses don't do photosynthesis, of course. Viruses simply invade other cells.
Well, have we done that to try to detect bacteria? Have we actually seen any of these planets around other stars and grabbed some of their light?
Answer hazy. Try later, Molly. But Matt Kenworthy, who's an astronomer at the University of Arizona, is one of the guys who's going to be trying. Matt, you're looking for planets, but planets around other stars. Now, people have been doing this for at least a dozen years. They found a couple of hundred of them. How are you doing it that's different from what's been done?
All the other planets which have been found indirectly. In other words, any separate picture of the planet hasn't been taken yet. What we're trying to do is actually take a picture of the planet itself.
Well, how can you do it when nobody's been able to do it before?
What we're trying to do is we're trying to see the planets with a different, longer wavelength of light. So there are these cameras which firemen can use to find people under buildings, and that uses longer wavelength light, much longer than our visible eye can see.
So you're talking about infrared?
Yes, infrared, exactly.
Now, as I understand it, the star will typically be maybe even billions of times brighter than the planet. And so the slightest defect in the telescope or the camera will produce all these ghost images. How are you going to beat that rap then?
So what we're going to do is we're going to use a special kind of mask where we can block out the light from the central star but allow the light from the planet to come straight on through into our camera. As you said, also we're using a technique where if you try to do this with visible light, like we can see with our eyes, then the contrast ratio is about 10 billion times fainter, which is really, really hard to measure. What we're doing is we're using this infrared light, and the planet, although it's still faint, will only be a million times fainter instead of 10 billion times fainter.
So the planet, I mean, it's like, you know, looking around a 100-watt light bulb for a bulb that's 0.0001 watts or something like that, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly. Okay. The way I say it is it's like looking for a needle beside a burning haystack on the next hill across.
Okay, and what have you done so far? Have you actually tried to find these things yet?
Oh, yes, we have. We worked out there are about 20 nearby stars that we can look at for giant planets, and we've just taken data for 6 of the 20 stars, and we're still in the process of examining the images and seeing if we've got anything exciting in the data. I'm pretty excited myself.
If you do find one, if you do find a dot, a pixel, if you will, that lights up and say, hey, that's not a defect in the mirror, that's actually a planet. What will it tell you other than, well, we found another planet?
But what we can then go on and do is look at the different colors from the planet. It's called spectroscopy, and we can actually tell what kind of chemicals are in the planet's atmosphere. And this will be really very exciting for all the astronomers to have a look at, and also tell us whether our models of how we think extrasolar giant planets are formed are correct or not.
Would you be able to find oxygen in the atmosphere? I mean, that might be a clue to life on that planet.
Much further down the line we could do that, but it would require a much, much bigger telescope, and maybe the next generation James Webb Space Telescope will be able to tell us something as exciting as that.
Finally, Matt, if you had to place a bet on when you're going to find your first planet, give me an indication of when you'd bet you'll do that.
Oh, man. If I was a betting guy, I'd definitely say within the next year or so you'll be hearing about it.
I expect to see that on the cover of Time magazine.
I hope so, too.
Matthew Kenworthy is an astronomer at the University of Arizona.
Coming up, we'll talk to someone who's trying to decide if our universe is the only kind that could have life. We'll also chat with an anthropologist who's keen to help out in case we encounter weird life in space. It's Are We Alone? Reporting from this year's Astrobiology Conference in Santa Clara, California. One of the nice things about the Astrobiology Conference, Molly, was the fact that there were a lot of big picture talks. You know, people thinking about the grand scheme of things, what sorts of worlds might have life and what might life as we don't know it be like, but also whether our universe is actually perfectly set up for biology.
Well, that's a big question, isn't it, Seth? I mean, scientists have said that if you were to change some of the fundamental physical constants of the universe, such as gravity, just slightly, then the stars wouldn't exist, nor would the planets. You and I wouldn't be here, neither would this radio program.
Well, that's true enough, and it's called the fine-tuning of the universe for life. But is it really so finely tuned? I talked to Eric Korpela about this. He's a research scientist at the Space Sciences Lab of the University of California at Berkeley. Eric, you're interested in the question of why the universe is so finely set up for life. There's been a lot of noise, or if you will, research results presented in the last, you know, 10 or 20 years that say if you change the fundamental physical constants of our universe, even a fairly small amount, maybe 10%, then you wouldn't have stars, planets, and this interview.
Well, if those parameters were far enough away, we wouldn't have shown up. So in that case, we couldn't answer the question. So there's a bias that we have just because we're here.
Well, tell me something about your own research into this question. How are you approaching this problem?
So rather than try and investigate those parameters of subatomic physics that people talk about being a little bit off, I tried to make the problem quite a bit simpler. So I thought about two parameters that are somehow, in a way that we don't understand, based on those fundamental physics parameters. So I considered the time scale that it would take on a typical Earth-like planet for life to arise, and the time scale after life arises that it would take for an intelligence capable of answering or asking that question, why are we here? So those two timescales, I think, would probably be a fundamental property of the universe and life. So I started a few million universes in my basement. actually on a computer, which does happen to be in my basement. And in each of those universes, I assigned a value for the actual timescale that it takes life to arise and an actual timescale that it takes life to evolve intelligence. And then I tried to work backwards. So if these are the actual timescales, what timescales would we measure?
And you found?
There's a pretty good chance that early origin of life on Earth is a fundamental property. But unfortunately, with one data point, you can't rule out the possibility that it takes much longer and that we got lucky. It's just any particular value of large time scale, for example, say 100 billion years rather than 100 million years, there's still a slight possibility that we got lucky and we're just ahead of the curve compared to where every other planet in the universe is. And when investigating the time scale for intelligence, it actually turned out that the longer time scale I investigated, the more likely that value got. So from that, I take it as an indication that, at least in the evolution of intelligence, we probably did get lucky. So I take it from that that intelligent life is probably fairly rare in the universe.
Well, you say that, if you put in that it took, 15 or 20 billion years instead of 4 billion years to produce intelligent beings, that seemed to be more probable. But, of course, our sun goes bad a lot quicker than that. So it's not going to happen on a sun-like star that you're going to find intelligence or around a sun-like star. So are you suggesting that maybe SETI ought to change its strategies and look at very old stars, the small stars that live for a long time?
It's possible that that's the way we should go. The problem with older stars is that they formed early in the history of the universe, and because of that, the way the universe evolved is it started out with very few heavy elements, and heavy elements got more and more common. So it might be more difficult in stars that are 10 billion years old for planets to have formed. But it probably isn't impossible.
So what I hear you saying is that the older a star is, the greater the chances that you'll have intelligent life. Well, that seems reasonable. Let me ask you this, finally. You've investigated those circumstances in which we got lucky. In other words, we appeared despite the fact that normally it might take very much longer for the experiment that produced us to work. Can you imagine universes in which this would happen much more quickly? And in other words, maybe instead of asking the question, why is our universe so finely tuned for our existence, maybe we should be asking why we got shoddy merchandise, why our universe isn't a lot better.
Well, to some extent, it's understandable that our universe wouldn't be the best place for life. Imagine that there were a lot of universes, and there are scientists at this conference who are doing just that and imagining lots of universes. If there's a range of these fundamental parameters where life is possible, if you pick a random universe where life is possible, chances are you're not going to pick the best one. Chances are that there are far more universes that are not optimal than there are optimal, because optimal means the best. There's only going to be one of those. So maybe there are values of these parameters where life is very abundant and that are significantly better than our universe. Maybe life happens everywhere in these universes, even where you don't have nice things like oceans or atmospheres. And maybe, people in those universes or whatever beings there may be are looking at us and saying, boy, they got stuck with a crappy universe.
Eric, I feel privileged to talk to you after merely 4 billion years of evolution on this planet. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Eric Korpela is a research scientist at the University of California in Berkeley.
You know, Molly, the universe may be nicely set up for life, but that doesn't mean that life's always easy.
That's right. There are always taxes and dishes to do, for one.
Yeah, well, actually—
You mean something else?
I do. I'm referring to species extinction.
Oh, yeah, that's bigger.
Well, it is bigger. I mean, everybody knows that the dinosaurs were wiped out in a cosmic scale catastrophe 65 million years ago. But there's some indication from the fossil record that catastrophes actually happen on a regular basis.
You mean from asteroid impacts?
Maybe, but maybe not. I mean, it's still a mystery, according to Richard Muller, a physicist at the University of California at Berkeley. Rich, probably just about all listeners will recall that the dinosaurs were wiped out by some sort of catastrophe 65 million years ago, but clearly that wasn't the only catastrophe that's befallen life on Earth.
What we've seen in the data is something that totally surprised us, even those of us who knew about the dinosaur catastrophe. What we see is huge fluctuations in the diversity of life. That's not extinctions necessarily, it's how many different types of animals there were on Earth at any time. And that's been going through these huge cycles that hadn't been noticed before because we didn't have a complete data set.
Well, variations in the diversity of species, but who was around to count how many species there were, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago? How do you know there was this change in diversity?
There's a wonderful record of past life that's kept on the ocean floor. As these animals die, they fall to the bottom. Many of the fossils are preserved. As this builds up over the years, we have what's almost a tape recording record of the history of life. In some places, these seafloor regions have now been lifted up above the seafloor, making mountains. We cut away and we get this record of human life. It's based on that record that we now have an enormous data set showing not only what animals were around, but how many different kinds of animals there were.
Okay, you've looked at this data set, presumably, and what did you find?
The data set shows that in addition to there being occasional great catastrophes, such as the one that killed the dinosaurs, there is a variation in the diversity of life that undergoes cycles every 62 million years. The number of species that you have at any one time changes. We could have twice the number of species, and then 30 million years later, that number has dropped. And then 30 million years after that, it comes back up. So we're seeing a change in the actual diversity, not necessarily coming about from animals going extinct. That will certainly reduce the diversity. But sometimes animals go extinct and are replaced. In that case, the diversity doesn't change. But what we're seeing is a large variation. It most likely has something to do with climate on the Earth or some other large change that's taking place on Earth.
So I take it from that you don't know why there's this cyclical behavior of the diversity record, as it were.
Well, we have some theories, and we've ruled out a lot of explanations. The ones we haven't ruled out, including a variation in the number of cosmic rays, I tend to think that it may be a variation as the solar system moves through the Milky Way galaxy, as we move through different regions of the galaxy, that the galaxy can actually be affecting life on Earth. There's
How would it do that? I mean, you know, you move through the galaxy, so what? How does that affect the number of species on our planet?
Well, the galaxy isn't completely uniform. There are regions of the galaxy that have a larger density of stars. When we get into those regions, our calculations show, in a way that's quite clear, that the number of comets hitting the Earth will increase. When we're in massive regions, we get more impacts. We know, based on the end of the dinosaurs, that impacts certainly do affect life on Earth, and this mechanism would change the number of impacts from, you know, might go from having impacts every 2 million years to one impact every million years. A change like that could certainly be one of the possible causes.
Do you think that we'll ever nail down what's causing this cyclical behavior?
Well, there's a lot of data that are coming in that I think will help us with this. We've been collecting much more data, for example, on the number of impacts on the Earth versus time. But there are other things, too. There are ways of checking to see whether volcanic eruptions might be the cause. We have some data that shows the volcanic eruptions seem to follow this pattern at least for the last 250 million years or so. And so that's suggestive that maybe volcanic eruptions are doing it. It's also possible the impacts are causing volcanic eruptions.
You know, the dinos and, a half or three-quarters of all other species were wiped out by a rock from space about 65, 66 million years ago. That sounds remarkably close to me, to the 62 million year cycle here. Are we due for another wipeout?
Well, the good news is no, but for an intriguing reason. There's the 62 million year cycle, but there's also another cycle that we see in the data, 140 million years. This is one, ironically, that we think we understand. This probably has to do with moving in and out of the arms of the Milky Way. That's a very good hypothesis. Right now, the 62 would be low diversity, but the 140 would be high diversity. In other words, these two effects seem to be canceling right now, so we're in luck.
Good news for the zoos. Rich Mueller, thank you for talking with me.
You're very welcome.
Richard Mueller is a physicist at the University of California in Berkeley. So, Seth, 3 days of nonstop talks, was it all physics, astronomy, geology, and biology?
Well, not entirely. I mean, astrobiology is a field of study that's as broad as a Kansas sky, Molly. And there were psychologists and anthropologists there, too, including Catherine Denning, an anthropologist at York University in Toronto. She tried to lay bare to these astronomer types what we should look out for in our search for strange life.
Catherine, you're an anthropologist. This is an astrobiology conference. Did you accidentally walk into the wrong room?
It's true. I cannot spell.
Well, what is an anthropologist's interest in this subject?
Well, what anthropologists do is we spend our lives attempting to confront weird culture. And in that way, I mean weird to us, any culture that's different from our own. So we spend our lives trying to confront the strange, the unknown. And that's very similar to what astrobiologists are trying to do. They're trying to anticipate weird life elsewhere. That intellectual challenge of confronting just the idea of something that's very different, whether it's weird life, weird intelligence, weird culture, any of those things, it's the same mental gymnastics that are involved in terms of discarding your assumptions about what life, intelligence, or culture is or should be like. Once you can discard those assumptions, then you have a chance of seeing something really new and really strange.
Well, let's turn to the more intelligent variety of potential extraterrestrial life. Now, you said in your talk that you can't do science by simply looking for what you expect.
True. I mean, you can do that kind of science simply looking for what you expect, but then you only find what you expect. So as any practicing scientist knows, method is only part of it. The other part of it is simply being alert to unexpected results, to surprises. That's where a lot of true discoveries happen.
Well, do you think that our SETI searches, for example, are too anthropocentric? In other words, you know, that we're assuming that the aliens are very much like us, so they may have gray complexions and big eyes, but they're fundamentally like us?
I don't actually think that that's true. My impression of the way that most SETI science works is that you're working to the limits of the available technology. So it's not that you're necessarily assuming that alien intelligence is like us, it's that you're using the methods that we have available that reach as far as possible into interstellar space. But if we were going to talk about seriously expanding searches into novel spaces, one of the first things that we need to think about is the full range of possibilities for intelligent life and civilizations elsewhere.
What do you think anthropology is able to bring to the table here? I mean, we should be open to a wide range of possibilities, but that just sounds like apple pie and motherhood.
It does sound like apple pie and motherhood in the sense that both of those things sound very easy, but they're actually quite difficult to do well. So making a good apple pie is not all that simple because it involves the knack for pastry. Motherhood is similarly regarded as a good thing, but it's not easy. And this is the strength of anthropology, I think, in the philosophical principle that it brings, is the idea of just relentlessly identifying and discarding your own assumptions about how things are or should be.
In your talk, you spoke about trying to understand weird intelligence on its own terms and in its own right. Could you tell me what you meant by that?
What I meant by that was getting rid of the way that we've traditionally confronted, for example, weird intelligence here on Earth. So when, for example, primatologists or anthropologists first started looking at ape intelligence, the question was always, well, how precisely is it inferior to our own? We were interested in them insofar as they were not us. More recently, the trend has become to try to understand them in their own right. How do they think, instead of just in what ways are they not us? And that's the shift in principle that I'm talking about when we're talking about understanding weird intelligence. We haven't met any interstellar or extraterrestrial intelligence yet, but if we ever do, I would really hope that we would be mentally prepared and philosophically prepared to engage with it in its own right, instead of, again, just the ways in which it is not human.
So, finally, Catherine, if the aliens were to land, not that I expect this, and I doubt that you do either, but if they were to land next week, would you advocate the presence of an anthropologist for the welcoming team?
Certainly. I think that would be an excellent idea, yes.
And maybe yourself.
I would probably show up for such an occasion, yes, thank you.
Catherine Denning, thank you for talking to me.
Anytime.
Catherine Denning is a professor of anthropology at York University. Well, Seth, have you sufficiently covered your astrobiology?
Nice suggestion. Actually, there was lots more, as the television commercials would say. But we've come to the end of this show, so I think we'll just have to leave it there.
Our thanks to Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance for their expert and invaluable help, and to the NASA Astrobiology Institute for their support.
And, of course, to the SETI Institute, whose mission is to understand the nature and origin of life beyond Earth. www.seti.org.
You can find Are We Alone on Facebook and MySpace, so please pay us a visit, although that visit is free. And oh yes, be sure to check out our new blog by going to the show's website and clicking on the Are We a Blog link.
Wasn't that how life got started, Molly, in some warm little blog?
I don't think that that's the theory anymore, Seth.
Well, at any rate, it sounds more comfy than a deep sea vent. Too hot.
Support for Are We Alone provided by Sun Microsystems, the inventor of Java, who invites you to visit java.com to see how Java is creating a world without boundaries.